Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network.
And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, we'll go back in time, the season's past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score, which would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and its Memorabilia on the Gridiron Greats Publishing and Broadcasting Network, in conjunction with Swick Enterprises. And we're live from the Southport, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America which focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia, and you can find us on the web app GridironGreatsMagazine.com. Is at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian, specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Largess. He hails from Portland, Oregon. Mr. Joe Squires, welcome to the show this evening.
Captain, always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. Got a great show lined up. I'm excited.
Should be very interesting with some very, very pertinent news. But before we get into that, we're going to continue our discussion of Bowman football sets. And tonight, we're going to spend a little time on the 51 set, but spend most of our time on the 52 set. So I'm going to hand off to you. Let's do a little quick review on the 51s and then get into the bread and butter of the 52 Bowmans.
And I'll admit, 52 set is the more popular, obviously, but I love the 51 set. It is beautiful. The logos, you know, the colorization got some amazing cards, you know, and the Norm Van Brocklin's rookie card. It's got a really nice follow-up, you know, Bulldog Turner, just amazing color, great logos. 51 Bowman is one of my favorites, but it just simply doesn't get the attention that the other Bowmans do because it just doesn't have the star power. I mean, it's got, you know, Tom Landry. You know, a lot of the rookie cards were in, you know, the 50 Bowman because it was the first Bowman set. So they kind of caught up. It's a shame, but it's just a beautiful set. They're larger. The 50 Bowman was square. These are 2 1/16 by 3 1/8. The 52 Bowman are 2 1/16 by, or excuse me, the largest 2 1/2 by 3 1/8. So it's a little bit larger, you know, by about, you know, what would it be, 15, 16, about half an inch, you know, on the vertical side. But mm-hmm. just It's a great set, and it is just—it's a shame it doesn't get, the notoriety that others do. But I get it, and and then here you and I are, continuing that by like briefly skimming over the 51, which is a beautiful set, and then talking about the 52. But it is what it is, you know.
Well, the 51 set, in my opinion, especially when I was putting it together, it seemed to be much easier to put together than either the 50 or the 52 set. The 52 set was nasty for me because I only did the small at first, and then it took me quite a while to find, obviously, the last card, and I basically just got a filler card for my Lanceford there, number 144. But Bowman Large, as I've said numerous times on the show, I've started and stopped numerous times, again, selling off the last set I was trying to put together right before I moved down here. So, again, right now I decided for 52 Bowman Large, I'm just going to pick up a couple Packer cards for type purposes, and that's about it. Yeah. But again, back to what you're saying, I do agree. 52 is a beautiful set. 51 is a nice set, but it's just not.
Yep.
Doesn't have that exciting star power like sets from the 50s have.
Yep, but the 144 cards, very similar to the 50 Bowman and the 52 Bowman, so likely laid out on a sheet the same way. 12 teams. So, 12 NFL teams, this is after, we discussed in the, the 50 Bowman, the merger of the AFC along with the NFL. So, likely four sheets of 36 like they did with the 50 Bowman, although I've never seen a 51 Bowman sheet. I have seen a 52 Bowman sheet, a partial one, but, missed out on it, but. Just not the star power, not the star power. Yeah, the only real Hall of Fame rookie card in there is the Norm Van Brocklin card number 4, which is just beautiful. But yeah, it is what it is. It's I love it. I'm the odd man out. The 51 and the 53 Bowman set are to me the nicest sets. I love them all. The Bowmans are amazing, except for the 54. It starts to get a little lazy and ugly in 54 and 55, but just good looking sets. Shame they don't get the notoriety that others do. I really like it. You start to see it more from the squares in 1950 to a little more vertical in 51, and then in 52 they settle in with their standard card size.
Now refresh my memory again. You just have like a partial cut of 51 and 52. I forgot what you had mentioned before.
I have all four sheets of 1950. I've never seen an uncut sheet of 51, but it's the same number of cards as the 50 and 52. The 52 sheet that I've seen has been tracked with the same layout as the 52 or as the 50 or the 50, excuse me, which is card 1 through 36. So, which is where you get the divided by 9, because it was 4 rows of 9. So you get the, divided by 9 plus 1. So you get, 9, 18, 27, 36 in your right border, if you're looking at it from the back. So which is why those divisible by 9 cards are corners and the edges, which makes them tough. But, four sheets of 36 likely, there's your divisible by 9 formula. It's kind of fun. Divisible by 9 plus 1 is what it is. So.
Okay. Now, again, we talked about this in the past. Why do we think Bowman went to a small in a large version of those cards? And the speculation we had was, and I'll hand it off to you first, and then I'll throw in my theory too.
Yeah. It's slightly smaller, like I said, about in 51, slightly smaller, about half inch in 51. And in 52, they continued with that, slightly smaller size, 2 2/16 by 3 1/8. The 52 small came first. football season. And then baseball rolls around, the 52 tops, and, you know, and this is back when there were, you know, the two sheriffs in town, Bowman and Tops. 52 tops baseball came out, and they came out with standard sizes. So Bowman had the small set out, and then, you know, and they were running with it. And then a little while later, the, you know, the 52 tops baseball set came out, and they were standard sizes. You know, I would imagine there was some market research that showed kids loved the larger baseball card, you know, larger cards a little bit more. So Bowman was forced to bump it and come out with the 52 large. So, which is why the 52 large is a lot more rare. They ran half the season with 52 small before they pumped out the 52 large. And then in 53 going, you know, 54, 55, Bowman just gave up and said to Helton, just went with the large size, you know, in sequence after that. But that's why it was just, you know, literally reactionary to 52 tops of baseball that came out after 52 Bowman small set came out.
And again, it's interesting to see that, like you said, the 52 Bowman large, much more difficult to put together than the 52 small. And again, I remember years ago putting the 52 Bowman small set together. I pretty much, even though I had a tough time with the stars, I did see those cards at shows. I rarely would ever see a 52 Bowman large card. And I want to say, not referring to my notes, but I would guesstimate it wasn't until the late 1980s I started seeing them a little more in volume at the shows. But at the same time, I always said to myself, well, if I'm putting together the small set, what do I need the large set for? And several dealers at the time said, oh, you should try to put it together. And then, again, 52 Bowman large lands for number 144. On a lot of people's want list, and it's a super expensive card, and you know, it just was not cost effective for me to actively try to pursue that set. And again, I tried to put that set together four separate occasions, got rid of it all four times, and I'm still very much more content with my 52 small set, knowing that in 53 I'm at the large size card, and 53 Bowman was a relatively easy set, believe it or not, to put together for me.
Yep.
Many years ago.
Who's Jim Lansford? I mean, he was a nobody player, but number 144 card is in the lower right section of the sheet. The right side tended to get trimmed a little easier because the left border goes against the guide rail. Lower right, so it's getting banged around. So the 144 card and the number one card are the rare ones. They're the tough ones. But Jim Lansford it's like when I talk about Zeke Bratkowski, you know, if you're an avid 57 tops collector, you know who Zeke Bratkowski is. It's a bear of a card to get because of where he lays on the sheet, the lower right section of the second sheet. And Jim Lansford is the same. I mean, just the fact that you threw that out, nobody knows who Jim Lansford is unless you collect that set.
Right.
It's comical to me
to see, because again, since I collect raw sets, I had no intention of, if, you know, people are saying, well, you know, you should really get this, if you put the set together for the 52 Bowman large, you should really get your last card graded. And I said, for what? It's going to cost even more money. And I don't see how you're going to really be able to touch up that kind of card, because I never really saw it in good condition. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
The handful of times I can count on one hand I actually saw the card in person, it was at best GBG because of, like you said, where it's located on the sheet and how it got cut. Simple.
Yep.
You know?
Four Hall of Fame rookie cards, and a lot of what drives the price and popularity of these is the Hall of Fame rookie cards. There are four Hall of Fame rookie cards in the 51 set. Number four, Norm Van Brocklin, Oregon, U of O Duck, go Ducks. Number 21, Arnie Weinmeister. Number 51, Ed Sprinkle. And card number 51, M. Tunnell. And then you roll over to 52, and it is there are two sets that have the most Hall of Fame rookie cards in them, and that is the 52 tops and the 84 and the 84 tops. I think 48 Leaf is right up there.
Mm-hmm.
But 52 Bowman and 84 tops. They are both chocked with star power. Frank, and in the 52 Bowman set, Frank Gifford, Gino Marchetti, Hugh McElhaney, you know, RIP, sorry, Art Donovan, Wayne Milner, Les Richter, Andy Robustelli, Bobby Dylan, recent addition, Joe Stidahar, Ollie Mattson, and Jack Christensen. I beg your pardon, Yale Larry wraps up card number 140 in the bottom row. I want to say that's 12 or 14, but just absolutely chocked full of Hall of Fame power. So that that really pushes the prices up on 52 Bowman. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's just, to me, those two sets never made a lot of sense to me. And again, the understanding why 52 large is more money than the 52 small, I just could not see what the value of it was trying to put that set together when I had the 52 small already. And I need upgrades in my 52 small set anyways. I just assumed upgrade it than worrying about having a lesser grade large set. You know what I mean? So it is what it is. Always, always interesting. And it was always, to me, challenging to say the least to start and stop that set so many different times that I did. And I'm content now, not worrying that I'm not putting it together. But anyways, we have our guest is here. I'd like to introduce him, get started with that section of our show. I'd like to introduce our special guest. He has an incredible collection of Jim Thorpe cards and memorabilia items. He was last on our show back in May of 2019. He was our super collector in Gridiron Greats magazine in issue 67. He hails from Oklahoma. I'd like to welcome to the show our good friend, Mr. Michael Driscoll. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Captain, and Joe, my Thorpe brother, for inviting me on the show.
I love it. I will wear that with honor, being a Thorpe brother for you, my man.
And Mike, thanks for taking time out of your schedule to come back on, and I'm going to lead off by, if you could refresh our audience's memory, what made you start collecting Jim Thorpe and his different cards and memorabilia?
You know, it all started back when I was a young kid living on a farm of 160 acres, and it was alongside a 280-acre property my grandparents owned. So I grew up hunting and fishing a lot. My dad was a history and reading teacher and also a collector of everything. And one day he brought home Jim Thorpe, Indian Athlete by Guernsey Van Riper, and told me who Thorpe was and that Thorpe grew up about 30 miles west of our farm, and he could have actually even walked on our land while coon hunting as a boy my age, as it was common to travel those kind of distances while coon hunting. So I read the book, and I became Thorpe in my make-believe world as a child when I was hunting and fishing. We eventually had to move to a town, and that's when I discovered there were football, baseball, and basketball cards. And so I collected that until high school when other interests started dominating my life. Fast forward to the early 2000s, I started getting the sports collecting bug again and settled on collecting Thorpe. I started with collecting cards, and had acquired some nice ones like a PSA 7 and 8 of the Sport Kings and a 1922 Z-Nut and a PSA 8 1955 All-American and a 1916 PSA 3 Famous and Bar. But I quickly found out that Thorpe didn't have many original cards, and the ones that surfaced were real hard to acquire, so that's when I started shifting my focus to photos and postcards and other types of memorabilia. It was a rewarding move for me, for sure.
That's a great story.
Totally agree. There's not much out there, you know, for Thorpe as far as mainstream cards, and it's just by the time 33SK came around, you know, Jim Thorpe was no longer the president of the NFL. He was, you know, in movies and digging ditches, unfortunately. In 2012, 10 years ago, on the 100-year anniversary of the 1912 Olympics, I started digging into how Jim Thorpe did in the decathlon. And then I started comparing it to modern-day athletes. And I started noticing it was almost 50 years before people broke Jim Thorpe's records from 1912. That's equipment and training, et cetera. But
yes.
Before that, 10 years ago, you know, in 2012, I had no idea, you know, to me, Jim Thorpe won the Olympics, you know, the pentathlon and decathlon. And until I started doing that research, I didn't know that it was a dual gold medal award. And I remember digging into why. And I'd kind of heard he had his medal strip, but recently why we wanted to have you on the show was the IOC recently announced that Jim Thorpe was being reinstated as the sole and on top of the heat winner of the decathlon and pentathlon, the 1912 Stockholm Olympics. Talk to us about how that happened and what the journey was like for that.
Oh, my gosh. You know, Ollie, I ought to have some thank yous to the 110-year struggle. Immediately in 1913, the New York mayor started a petition asking the AAU to reinstate the Thorpe as an amateur, because the feeling throughout America at the time was, since he made a clean confession and truly believed he was innocent, that he should be shown some mercy. However, James Sullivan, who was the head of the AAU, was also on the school board of New York Public Schools. And so politically, petition didn't go far. Then you have Gus Welch, who was quarterback for Carlisle, and his roommate, Thorpe's roommate, and also his best man at his wedding, got an investigation started almost immediately that revealed things that we might not have ever known that could have helped this later on. You also had back then Charlie Paddock, who in 1920 was the 100-400 relay Olympic champion. Yep. And if anybody remembers Chariots of Fire, he was involved in that 100-meter final and placed fifth. So that's who we're talking about. Yep. He managed several newspapers at the time, and he wrote several articles in support of Jim Thorpe, which pointed out that the rules, illegality of the ruling by the AAU should have prevented him from being stripped of his medals and honors. At the time, everybody knew the rules, and eventually those rules got lost and faded to memory until later on when Florence Ridlon, which is Robert Wheeler's wife, found a set of the rules in the Library of Congress, which again proved that everything was done illegal. Then we go to modern day. A guy by the name of Tex Brown in 1970 started working with Grace Thorpe and her and the Thorpe family to have
his daughter.
Yes, to have the medals and honors restored. However, he died in 1984. So about the time things were getting going, you know, in 83, he finally got some replica of his awards. In 72, he was reinstated. Then Tom Benji, who's a Carlisle historian, has routinely been publicly and written articles on his behalf. Nita Darling, who started the Bright Pass Strong, which has really snowballed this into what happened a couple days ago. than Billy Mills, who was Olympic champion at the Munich Olympics in the 10,000 meters. His fame has helped give the fight a boost. Even in 2019, New Mexico Congresswoman Deb Haylen, who's a Native American, introduced legislation calling on the IOC to correct the results. Of course, you have Grace Thorpe and other family members, probably more than anybody, Robert Wheeler and his wife, Florence Ridlon, since 1975, has been fighting this fight. And without their undying work, this final leg might have never happened. They kept it in the forefront since 1975. And to fully understand and appreciate what happened and the full scope of the tragic misjustice, then key players and their roles and the basic tendencies in relation to their jobs and how they were all connected has to be talked about. It is a multifaceted situation with several key people involved. And my intention is not to disparage Warner or Sullivan, James Sullivan or Pop Warner, Glenn Warner. Their contributions to their respective fields are undeniable. The modern-day football was brought into play by Glenn Warner. So his football contributions are undeniable. And, of course, we can look back, and it's easy for us to hang our hat on things that we know now. And these guys aren't alive to take up for themselves, so I'll just stick to the known facts. And I believe most will conclude that they did things for reason at the time, and perhaps not the right reason. Unfortunately, it's taken 110 years to undo what they did then. So the key players and organizations at the time was reporter Roy Johnson, who broke the story. And Thorpe never did, and he admitted he never did hold any ill feeling towards Roy Johnson, that he was a reporter and he was just doing his job. You had James Sullivan, so he's the head of the AAU, and he's also the advertising editorial and sales manager for A.G. Spalding. He bolstered his and Spalding's bottom line by denying any records that were set if the athlete was not using Spalding equipment or shoes. So, say a 100-meter record was broken. He asked the athlete, were you wearing Spalding shoes? And if the guy said no, and this happened, then he denied the record because he was not wearing Spalding shoes. A discus set a world record. And but he did not use a Spalding discus. Therefore, he denied the record. And this forced,
I did not know that.
Yes, this forced athletes at the time to buy Spalding equipment, which he got a commission off of.
Yep.
So you're talking about a man who, if he was alive today, it'd be like one man as head of Sports Illustrated, Nike, ESPN, NCAA, and the U.S. Olympic Committee. One man was running all this. He ruled the AAU amateurs with a ironclad fist. He even took away the amateur status of a nephew of his because he played in a non-sanctioned AAU basketball tournament.
Incredible.
So,
wow.
He also operated the American Olympic Committee without a constitution or procedural rules. So basically, he could make up the rules as he went. It's kind
Why
of
was he allowed to do that?
Sketchy.
Yeah. Incredible.
Yeah, it's kind of sketchy that immediately after his death, his business papers were destroyed. So they're lost
for
time, so nobody will ever know what his business papers look like. Then you had, during that time, James Conley was writing articles. He was the first American to win gold in the modern Olympics. He testified that Solomon used a number of ways to compensate athletes without paying them, the very thing that he's accusing Thorpe of, getting compensation. One way was to award gold watches to winners. And these athletes called them stock watches because the athletes would return them to the stores where the watches would be put back in stock, while the athlete would be reimbursed with cash. And there's even a known instance where Thorpe received one, but it's reported that he gave it to a girl on campus. Also, said that Sullivan and the AAU promoters used as a way of gaining control of American athletes, amateurs, by paying them extra expenses, then bribed them to be exposed as a professional if they didn't attend the events he wanted them to attend. And everybody knew at the time that he was helping Howard Drew, who was the world record sprinter at the time, by allowing him to run for free and helping him get to track meets because he was so poor and he didn't have anybody to help him.
This disgusts me.
So,
Mike,
a lot of sketchy things with Sullivan.
Investigating this, as you're investigating this, it's just got to make you mad. I mean, how many?
Oh, yeah.
Is this something that was racist? Is this towards because he didn't like Native Americans, or did this happen to a lot of other people? Sounds like, you know, if they're threatening people to not compete at the events they want to, it was all over the place. But stripping somebody of medals was a little
I'll
beyond.
I'll touch on that in a minute. Another key player was Pop Warner, who hunted with Thorpe extensively. And even his own records indicated when some players would leave to play baseball in the summer, and he would brag openly about his players doing well in summer ball. He ended up dropping baseball at Carlisle in 1910 because of summer professionalism, so he knew his athletes were doing it. And I don't know if y'all have ever hunted with anybody, but your buddy, you talk about with everything. So it's hard to imagine that that summer ball did not ever come up in conversation when they were out on hunting trips. But I digress on that. That, you know, nothing, that's not proven. It's just hard for me to believe that didn't happen. It's also known that Warner bet on his own games all the time, and he'd bribe his players at halftime if they were losing, as he had bet on Carlisle to win. So players said, hey, he'd tell them for everybody and some spending money if y'all go out and kick their butt second half and win. He'd put out false injury reports just to alter the betting odds. So he's not completely clean. And all these things kind of tend to make people think, were these guys honest in what they were saying about not knowing about Thorpe?
I hate to interrupt you again, but, I mean, you and I on a previous show talked about, I personally don't like Thorpe, Pop Warner.
And right.
Because Pop Warner sold Thorpe down the river, he didn't defend him when the IOC started investigating. I mean, a man of Pop Warner's stature could have been the person whose voice that stood up and, you know, maybe gave them pause of stripping these medals away from a Native American, a shy one like Thorpe. I don't know. Warner gets a lot of accolades. He's held in very high standards.
Sure.
I've never found him to be a very honest, good man, and hearing more of this just reinforces that.
You know, that's the very reason Gus Welch called for a government investigation into the administration of Pop Warner at Carlisle, because he was mad that they did not defend Thorpe. And he said he knew that they knew. So during that investigation, Welch testified that Warner would scalp 50 to 75 tickets per game that were intended to go to patrons and pocket it. And players witnessed the scalping. Welch said under oath, "I regard him as a great coach for being a dishonest person. He is a man with no principles." This is Gus Welch, his own quarterback.
Wow.
And indeed.
I didn't know that. Wow.
An investigation at the school revealed that between 1907 and 1913, Warner, as president of his own athletic association, had netted $7 million in today's value. In 1908, Warner supposedly handed out $9,233 in payments and loans to his athletes, including $500 to Thorpe. Now, Warner, under oath, denied that he had paid his players, yet players in the investigation said they were paid for touchdowns, tackles, interceptions, and et cetera. Warner did admit he paid for players to get a $25 suit, $25 overcoat, and a souvenir, and people say that that souvenir was a gold watch and gold fob. The report did say that money from the Athletic Association was spent on building and refurbishing five buildings, including a new two-story home for Warner to live in. And he paid himself $4,000 a year and invested some of the funds into railroad stock. So it's ironic that the American Olympic Committee wrote in their report to the IOC, quote, "Warner as a man is a man whose reputation is of the highest and whose accuracy of statement has never been doubted," end quote.
Oh, gee. The more disgusting this is.
Keep in mind that Thorpe was an orphan at this time and had no lawyers, money, advisors, or mentors other than Warner, who'd been looking out for him for 6 years.
Yep.
You also had Moses Friedman, who's the superintendent of Carlisle School. He was indicted for embezzling money in 1911 before the Olympics for double billing train tickets for the students and carrying 186 phantom students on enrollment books, which led to $32,000 in government overpay. So most people back then thought he was lying because he was stealing. So how can you take his word that he didn't know that Thorpe was playing baseball? So Sullivan, Warner, and Friedman, the top three guys, were all doing less than honest things, yet the three together are the ones who sunk Thorpe. How ironic.
Yeah. And well, not ironic. Well. Damn sad. Damn sad. That's even worse. I mean, I always imagine this came down, and, you know, IOC wasn't happy with Thorpe. You know, a lot of people play ball. This is, you know, this is, I don't know, it's, you know, not to say everybody in college football cheats a little bit, but, I mean, this is, you know, right up there. Everybody played a little bit of, you know, college ball, you know, et cetera. It's just, It seemed like Thorpe was kind of, you know, picked out because he was Native American. And I just, and even worse than Pop Warner letting him, you know, get, you know, sail down the river without defending him.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Warner did that because of football, because of him moving away from that. I don't know. Man, it's so sad.
For the modern day, Avery Brundage, he was the American Olympic Committee president from 28 to 53 and the IOC president from 52 to 72. And any attempts from friends or family met ironclad rejection while he's in charge. With Thorpe out of the way, he won three all-around championships for the U.S. and later admitted that it opened up opportunities for his construction business. So he categorically dismissed all attempts by Grace Thorpe and family and Robert Wheeler and others to get the order reinstated. Not until his forced retirement in 72 after his insensitive posture and remarks to the killings of the Israeli athletes in Munich, you're old enough to remember that, did Thorpe start getting any justice. Because the following year, after he retired, the new president reinstated Thorpe's amateur status. And in 82, that's when Wheeler's wife found the official rule book at the Library of Congress. And once again, Rule 13 proved that what was done was not only unfair but illegal. So in October 82, the IOC voted to restore the honors, but only as co-champion. So what is Rule 13?
Why only as co-champion? Apologize.
Do what?
Why only as co-champion then?
Because they were not going to relegate those who they had already replaced as champions. It was their justification.
And Mike, I'm curious, to cut in here, where are Thorpe's actual two-strip gold medals from the 1912 Olympics? Do you know?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
No. They did the IOC did crate them all up, and they were housed at the IOC headquarters in Switzerland for some time. Then all of them disappeared until they did find the bust of the King of Sweden. It was discovered in one of their warehouses, and it now resides in a museum. But his medals and Viking ship have never surfaced. So to me, it's either they reside in a private collection somewhere that no one's ever going to reveal, or remember, two world wars happened in Europe, and entire cities were destroyed, so they could easily have been lost forever. I'm kind of in the thought that nobody will ever know.
Interesting. Who was it on a VFC? I think it was you. I'm looking at the post now, who said, they were taken from Thorpe, either at his residence or at Warner's residence. But somehow or another, Warner ended up with them, either, you know, going to Thorpe's house or gathering up in his own residence and returned to Sweden. So the line is that you believe is they were returned to Sweden. By then, Sweden had already struck two new ones, for the second place person. But second place person refused to them, correct?
No, they were going to receive those actual medals, but they refused to accept them. I mean, they had set up a day to present them and everything, and the runner-ups refused, said, "We're not coming, we're not going to take them." He beat us fair and square.
Yeah, man, good for them, because absolutely.
So, Rule 13, which was quoted in the U.S. and international papers at the time, I've got actual newspaper articles. It's objections to the qualifications of a competitor must be made in writing to the Swedish Olympic Committee before the lapse of 30 days from the distribution of prizes. So July 22nd was the distribution of prizes. August 22nd, time was up. And this all broke on January 22nd, 5 months too late. The American press published many reminders from Swedish officials that the challenge to Jim's win and awards had come too late. Not only that, but a provision in the 1912 rules for a court of appeals that specifically dealt not with the challenges to the outcome of any event, but with interpretation and application of rules governing the games. Such protests had to be made within 1 hour of the event in question. Otherwise, the judge's decision was final. Sweden was trying to head Sullivan off at the pass, but Sullivan and AAU disregarded everything, and Sullivan was directing Vince, therefore he preemptively stripped Jim of his amateur status. So what that's saying is that the placings had to be challenged within 1 hour. But the eligibility of the person had to be within 30 days, and neither was followed.
Yeah, 7 months, I think you mentioned.
Yeah, American newspapers condemned the ruling, since Thorpe had received very little money. Then how was it that Brickley from Harvard and Flynn of Yale during the recent football season could make more money from one article they wrote for the papers than Thorpe made in an entire season, yet they both retained their amateur status? And in Sweden, a lot of support for the Nordic Sport Life magazine wrote, "There is growing anger to what is now an international scandal. Does anyone anywhere believe that the AAU and others involved didn't know about Thorpe's crime before the games?" Swedish athletes went on record that they disapproved and felt that the rules were too strict in America, and that they even were reimbursed financially for time lost from work for their training. And reports abroad were that Thorpe would get to keep the prizes he won, as the Swedish Olympic officials had declared in a meeting that the prizes could not be taken from Thorpe, since the Olympic rules expressly stated that all trophies shall remain the permanent property of the victor unless charges are preferred against an individual within 30 days after the prizes have been awarded. So there was a lot of support at the time. But what
Mike,
were the...
We got to move forward here because we're running out of time. So I got to bring up an incredible story that you've echoed here tonight. It's just truly amazing to me and to our listeners at the same time, hearing what really happened with it. So can you summarize, like, in 2 minutes or less, and then we'll go into just one more quick question because we've almost got 12 minutes left of the show. Summarize in 2 minutes or less, what is actually the final outcome of everything that has happened here?
Well, you know, the timeline of it from beginning to end happened in 10 days. From the time the story broke to the time he signed with the New York Giants baseball team. So 10 days, he was tried, he was accused, tried, convicted, and stripped of Olympic glory.
In the court of the press, yeah.
In the court of Sullivan and Warner and Friedman, for sure.
Yeah.
Wow. It's unbelievable.
It's interesting that Carlisle's Athletic Association board members included Moses Friedman and Sullivan, so they served on Warner's business enterprise, which made them in business together. That very business was based in part of what? Jim Thorpe's amateur status. So there's hardly anybody back then that did not believe there was something in the woodpile and that they were trying to hide something.
Unbelievable.
The whole thing. The whole thing makes me sad, and quite frankly, it depresses me that this went on, and it was such a badly kept secret, and everybody just let one of the greatest athletes of our time, you know, just get sent down the river. Like I said, just think about what else Thorpe could have accomplished with a little bit more support. And I think that was
cut
short.
He's going to go back to Carlisle and play. And he wanted to continue to go to some track meets. And, you know, he turned down a Pittsburgh Pirates offer before he went back to Carlisle. And there's documentation that he turned down $55,000 to become exclusively a boxer, because he was an accomplished boxer. And he turned all that down just to go back and play football for Carlisle as an amateur. So in his heart, but what's crazy is in his heart, and everybody who is in question here, other than Thorpe, had shady backgrounds, and Thorpe's the only one who did not was not accused of being dishonest.
And never spoke up about it, never complained,
never
begrudged. I mean, this guy died in poverty. I've shared that picture I have of him digging ditches in 1930. Mm-hmm. You know, the guy, he was robbed. He was robbed of, we were robbed of one of the greatest athletes. I mean, just again, I think about what would have, I mean, what he could have done. I don't know. It's just depressing.
The man in the whole thing was Thorpe. You know, whether Sullivan, Warner, and Friedman knew or not, they didn't fight enough for him, in most people's opinion. He remained loyal to Warner his whole life. We've seen pictures of him with Warner in old age. Friedman was invited to his wedding and gave Ivan Miller away, who was also an orphan. And he held no ill feelings toward Roy Johnson, who broke the story. He stayed cordial to every Brundage. His only strongest words later in life was for Sullivan, in which he said, basically, they used me as a guinea pig to make up the rules. That was his strongest statement his whole life about the entire episode publicly.
A gracious man who was wrong. And yeah.
Truly incredible. Truly incredible. Well, Mike, we're probably going to have you on a second show because we are running out of time. And I got to ask
I've got more that I could speak about, you know, if you wanted to.
Yeah, all right. Why don't we do that? We're gonna go off script. You got 5 minutes to summarize, and then
totally
we'll be down to 2 minutes for the show, and then just finish up from there. Okay. Go ahead.
The captain just called an audible. I like it.
Well,
ahead,
just
Mike.
A little tidbit. You know, without any doubt in my mind, what happened a few days ago was 110 years too late. But most happy for the Thorpe family, especially. You know, a lot of people involved, but this comes down to the Thorpe family getting justice. It doesn't matter about us collectors, about anybody else who has fought, you know, kudos to them, but this comes down to the Thorpe family finally getting justice, and can't be more than happy that that has happened for them.
Hmm.
That kind of sums it up.
I'm curious what Thorpe never said anything about Pop Warner.
No, he stayed. You know, understand he was an orphan, and during his formative years, Warner was that father figure who took the place of his parents who passed away, and he remained extremely loyal to Warner, no matter what.
Did
never
anyone tell Thorpe, like, by
no,
the way,
no,
that guy?
Even his children have stated that before they passed away that he never said anything bad about Warner, and that he did not bring up the topic of his of what happened back then.
Hmm.
So he just, you know, now it was deeply rooted. You know, there's a time that he told Chief Myers, who he played with in their room late at night, you know, that he was, you know, he was even crying about it, that those were hit, should have been his awards, and that he won them fair and square, and that they should not have been taken from him. So in private moments, I'm sure there were some sometimes, but publicly, he never disparaged anybody.
What a gentle giant, you know. I don't know.
Yes, and, you know, that's what a lot of his teachers at Carlisle described him as a gentle giant and guileless. They never saw him want to get revenge on anybody.
Well, makes me angry. Even if he didn't want to do it, it seems like somebody could have, you know, somebody could have stepped up for him. Oh, well. Like I said, I'll admit, Pop Warner to me is the one person who had the power to step in on this and didn't. Is that how you feel as well?
I do. I believe that. I know he took care of Thorpe for many years, but still yet that one time that he really needed him the most, he didn't fight for him. And, of course, if it would have been found out that Warner and Sullivan knew for sure that he had played, that would have ruined their careers. And so it was hastily taken care of. And even all involved, Clancy, who was the coach down there, and Friedman and Warner and Thorpe, they all denied it initially until concrete evidence came out. Then yep. Clancy went to the papers and started disparaging Thorpe as being yellow and had a yellow streak in him and a drunk and troublemaker. And the other three started gathering the things they needed to cover their rear.
A truly amazing story. It's just a lot to digest, and it's just amazing to hear one of the greatest athletes of all time have to go through that. It's just sad. It really is sad.
Really sad. I mean, in 10 days, what happens in 10 days? You know?
Yep.
Everything. It was signed, sealed, and delivered like they knew exactly what they had to do if this ever came out, and they put it in motion.
Somebody was very mad at him. Yep, I agree.
All right,
interesting.
I got to step in. Hard close here because we're down to 2 minutes. Mike, we got to have you on for a second half of the show to talk about all that great stuff you picked up since the last time we talked to you. But
okay.
I want to thank you for being on, and you are the expert on what happened. And you are the expert on his memorabilia, photos, cards, and the like. Truly, you have an amazing collection and an amazing knowledge of what really happened. And I want to thank you for being on tonight. And we'll be back soon. We'll be in touch.
Okay. Now, thank you, guys.
Mike, I can't thank you enough for being on the show. At the top of the hour, you saying my fellow Thorpe collector, it was such an homage to me. I appreciate it, man. I'm honored to be in that company.
There's still a few of us out there. All right.
We're down to...
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Down to 1 minute, Joe. Quick 30-second wrap-up here. What'd you pick up on tonight's show? And it's tough to...
I'm angry.
I'm angry at what
could have been if Thorpe was allowed to thrive. I'm angry that an innocent man was sold down the river by the people closest to him that he trusted. Just that there's a lot of stuff I didn't know there, and it's a lot to unpack. It's just sad.
Yeah. It's sad. It's just a sad story. And at least, you know, for lack of a better way of explaining it, it got resolved 110 years later, which really isn't acceptable one way or the other. Hey, we're out of time. Thanks for listening. If you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats Magazine, what are you waiting for? Check out our website, gridirongreatsmagazine.com. We'll see you next week with another show.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.